Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading today from presidential historian Michael Beschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on Franklin Delano Roosevelt during World War II entitled The Survival War. We pick up the story in late 1942. The war has been going on for almost a year, and Roosevelt has authorized the go-ahead of the Manhattan Project, which will end in the creation of the atomic weapon. November 1942 would bring the first national wartime midterm election since World War I. Pollsters found many voters angry about rationing, shortages, government bureaucracy, what seemed like Allied foot-dragging in striking back at the Nazis, and naval setbacks in the Pacific. The New Republic magazine claimed that November's balloting would be the most crucial since the Civil War. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt told reporters that such a judgment was perfectly silly because this time, unlike 1864, both political parties shared a passion to fight the war through to the end. After an air raid against the U.S. Navy base at Alaska's Dutch Harbor in June, a Japanese flotilla had established itself in the Aleutian Islands. Aroused by frenzied newspaper coverage about this invasion of U.S. territory, some Americans feared that from its new foothold, the enemy could bomb the West Coast. Senator A.B. Happy Chandler, Democrat from Kentucky, called the occupation of the Aleutian Islands a direct threat to Americans, stating, "Whatever it takes, we must get those fellows out of there." Having vetoed an effort to retake Europe that year, the Allied armies were unready for that. Roosevelt and Churchill had secretly agreed to launch Anglo-American troops into the battle against the Axis powers in North Africa under Operation Torch. When General Marsham briefed the president on its progress, President Roosevelt pretended to pray, joking, "Please make it before Election Day." When General Marshall later told the president that they needed more time, Marshall found that Roosevelt never said a word of objection and was very courageous. The president remembered the backlash against Woodrow Wilson's public appeal to endorse his war leadership in 1918 by voting Democratic. Instead, with Eleanor Roosevelt, his wife, present for the early part of the railroad journey that fall, he took a two-week, 8,754-mile non-political inspection tour of military installations, war factories, and naval hospitals. Wartime security compelled the entire trip to be kept secret until Roosevelt was safely back at the White House. The president asked the train's engineer to keep down the speed, knowing that his paralyzed legs and unpadded rear end could not protect him from jolts on the train. Roosevelt stopped first at a Chrysler tank factory in Detroit, Michigan, rolling into the plant in his beloved open-topped Lincoln parade car called the Sunshine Special, complete with bulletproof windows that were rolled up to shield him from the side. Henry Ford showed him B-24 bombers being assembled by workers at Ford Motor Company at Willow Run, Michigan, including midgets, as they were called at the time, hired to work in difficult-to-reach spots on the plains. Outside Chicago, the president was driven through the rain around the Great Lakes Naval Training Station and Camp Robert Smalls, established the previous spring by the segregated U.S. Navy to train African-American seamen for the first time. There, Roosevelt stopped to listen to recruits sing a spiritual called Travelin'. In a dispatch embargoed until Roosevelt's return to Washington, Merriman Smith of the United Press reported that the commander-in-chief had watched as several hundred Negro commando soldiers ran their obstacle course, screaming like demons let loose. In Milwaukee, one plant worker shouted, "God Almighty, it's the president." At the shipyard in Bremerton, Washington, Roosevelt joked about the secrecy, saying, "You haven't seen me, and I'm not really here." Roosevelt later recalled that throughout his tour, He was happy to find that women were not merely doing sewing machine type work, but operating heavy machinery. Other stops included Portland, San Francisco, San Diego, El Paso, San Antonio, New Orleans, and Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Stopping at Uvalde in arid South Texas, Roosevelt welcomed his ex-Vice President John Nance Garner into his railroad car. Despite the rift that had moved Roosevelt to bounce Cactus Jack from his 1940 presidential ticket, the Texan tousled the president's hair and both men grinned for photographers. Roosevelt told Garner he had heard that thanks to war production, everyone in Texas was making a lot of money. After their brief visit, before driving away in his tiny car, Garner said, "God bless you, boss." While riding the rails, the president read W.L. White's new bestseller, They Were Expendable, about four U.S. Navy officers in the Battle of the Philippines. Among his party were two adoring guests, his purple-haired cousin, Laura Polly Delano, and his Hudson Valley friend and distant relative, Margaret Daisy Stuckley, who was working as an archivist in his library. Daisy was moved into Eleanor Roosevelt's stateroom after the First Lady's departure. She told her diary, "We all get along peacefully, and of course we all just think of him to make it nice for him." Without mentioning Eleanor Roosevelt, Stuckley boasted that the president had told her and Polly that he had never taken a more restful and satisfactory trip, which she took as a great compliment to us for not having controversial talk. Once the commander-in-chief was back at the White House, his secret tour was heavily publicized. Republican Congressman Charles Halleck of Indiana complained that the president's alleged inspection trips always seemed to precede elections. In a fireside chat about the journey, Roosevelt told Americans that when we drove unannounced down the middle aisle of a great plant, workers were arguing as to whether that fellow in the straw hat was really the president, and the first to look up from their work were the men, not the women. On Election Day 1942, Republicans almost took over the House of Representatives, reducing the Democratic margin to an advantage of 222 to 209. The Republicans also won 9 seats in the Senate, where the Democrats retained a majority of 57 to 38 seats. Now, there would be fewer Democrats in Congress than at any time since Roosevelt had become president. The young congressman, Lyndon Johnson of Texas, observed with chagrin, "All the boys who went down were Roosevelt men." Some blame the Democrats' loss on low turnout and the absence of younger voters, many of whom were away at the war or hard at work on assembly lines. The Chattanooga Times newspaper explained that voters extracted revenge in the farm states for Roosevelt's anti-inflation bill. The Journal of Portland, Oregon, felt that Democrats had suffered from the cumulative annoyances that the restraints of war impose upon a people. Joseph Kennedy, smarting after the president had rebuffed his efforts to gain a prominent role helping to run the war, wrote his friend, the British publisher Lord Beaverbrook, that "Dissatisfaction is rife and lack of confidence in the leaders and in Congress is definitely high," adding that, short of a miracle, the New Deal is finished. Asked by White House reporters whether his very close majority in the Senate would now make a difference, Roosevelt responded, "Why should it? I assume that the Congress of the United States is in favor of winning this war, just as the president is." The following Sunday at Shangri-La, the rustic presidential retreat in Maryland, later called Camp David, Roosevelt watched films of his Western inspection tour and a new British movie picture, Next of Kin, about the dangers of spilling official wartime secrets. Referring to the military Operation Torch, Daisy Stuckley, who was present, told her diary, "For weeks, the president has had something exciting up his sleeve." That Sunday began the invasion under Operation Torch of North Africa. After the Allies' quick victory there, the president assured the New York Herald Tribune Forum, "I have made a constant effort as commander-in-chief to keep politics out of the fighting of this war." At the White House, in the earliest hours of New Year's Day, 1943, after a champagne dinner, Roosevelt, in his wheelchair, led Eleanor Roosevelt, the exiled Norwegian Princess Martha and Prince Olav, and other guests to the mansion's theater, where they viewed the new film Casablanca, starring Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. The president had not chosen the picture randomly. That month, he was secretly destined, flying for the first time of any president in office, for the ancient Moroccan port city, where he would meet with Churchill. Stalin had declined to join them. Only on Sunday, January 24th, the final day of their conversations, did most of the world learn that the two Allied leaders, Roosevelt and Churchill, were in Casablanca. In the sunlight garden of his borrowed Art Deco villa, with Churchill at his side, Roosevelt told reporters that they had discussed the whole global picture. It isn't just one front, just one ocean, or one continent. Roosevelt went on, stating, "We have all had it in our hearts and heads before, but I don't think that it has ever been put down on paper by the Prime Minister and myself, and that is the determination that peace can come to the world only by the total elimination of German and Japanese war power." The president noted that in his own country's civil war, we had a general called U.S. Grant, or Unconditional Surrender Grant. Now the only reasonable assurance of future world peace would be unconditional surrender by Germany, Italy, and Japan. "Hear, hear," replied Winston Churchill. "I agree with everything that the president has said." Roosevelt may have attributed his insistence on unconditional surrender to Ulysses Grant, but he was probably more influenced by 1918, when Woodrow Wilson had refused advice to keep fighting until Germany was absolutely defeated, and cousin Theodore Roosevelt had complained about Wilson's choice to end the war in compromise. But since Pearl Harbor, the president had avoided public mention of Woodrow Wilson, knowing how many Americans still disparaged his old chief as the champion of an unnecessary war. With Britain now so painfully dependent on American goodwill, Winston Churchill was scarcely in a position to refuse Roosevelt's demand for unconditional surrender. The president had sprung the notion on him during their final luncheon, insisting that it would show militance to the Germans and reassure Stalin that the British and Americans would not try to make a separate peace with Adolf Hitler. "Perfect," Winston Churchill had replied, adding that he could just see how the Nazis would squeal. Roosevelt had told him, "Uncle Joe might have made it up himself." Privately, however, Churchill knew that nothing would placate Joseph Stalin until the British and Americans agreed to send 50 divisions across the English Channel. He feared that unconditional surrender would steal the German people, having been told by their leaders that, if victorious, the Allies would enslave and destroy them, to fight to the bitter end, and that prolonging the conflict would hamper Germany's ability to act as a bulwark against Soviet power in post-war Europe. That same month in Washington, with Roosevelt's approval, Secretary of War Stimson announced that it was the inherent right of every faithful citizen, regardless of ancestry, to bear arms in the nation's battle. After Pearl Harbor, more than 2,000 men of Japanese origin had been thrown out of the U.S. Army, but now the War Department established two segregated combat units comprised of the sons of Japanese-American immigrants, including volunteers from the Japanese internment camps. One was a 42nd Regimental Combat Team, which would become one of the most honored military units in American history. In April 1943, wearing a starry blouse, beret, and broad smile, Eleanor Roosevelt arrived at the Japanese internment camp in the Arizona desert at Gila River. Feeling remorse over Executive Order 9066, Eleanor Roosevelt had been asking to visit one of the camps, but Franklin Roosevelt had refused until it was politically useful to him. By now, not only the racist John Rankin, but other members of Congress were claiming that the camps were too luxurious and that the government was coddling the Japs. Some wished to transfer oversight of the facilities from the War Relocation Authority to the less benign mercies of the U.S. military. Thus, when Franklin and Eleanor went to the southern Arizona border to meet the Mexican president, Roosevelt asked her to tour Gila River south of Phoenix, which was considered the most benign of the 10 Japanese internment camps. Its guard tower and barbed wire fence had been taken down after authorities concluded that no one was plotting to escape. The inmates raised chickens, hogs, and cattle, and grew cotton, corn, celery, and beets, feeding not only their own camp, but some of the others. However, Gila River's population of 14,000 had been forced into barracks built for two-thirds that number. During her 6-hour surprise visit, warned in advance that the food was less wholesome than advertised, Eleanor Roosevelt asked for a glass of milk, took a sip, and said, "It's sour." Addressing the inmates, she expressed regret for their incarceration, but also criticized the fact that they had clustered before the war in Japanese neighborhoods, which had kept them from assimilating into American society. She hoped that once released, they would scatter throughout the country. After leaving Gila River, Eleanor Roosevelt told the Los Angeles Times newspaper that the facility was certainly not luxurious, and I wouldn't like to live that way. She added that the sooner we get the young Japanese out of the camps, the better, because otherwise we will create another Indian problem. Her public assurance that no one was being pampered helped the president quash a Senate proposal to hand the camps over to the military. Eleanor Roosevelt lobbied in vain for the inmates to be set free. Throughout the war, Eleanor Roosevelt reminded her husband that personal liberties must not be crushed in pursuant of the security of the nation. Unlike Wilson, this president did not ask Congress for new restrictions on the free press or public speech. Such sanctions were less tempting than in 1917 under Wilson, because this time the country was far more united behind the war effort. But Roosevelt was more than willing to push the envelope in other ways. In 1940, although the Supreme Court had declared warrantless wiretapping illegal, Roosevelt secretly gave J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI wholesale authority to secure information by listening devices, assuring his then-Attorney General Robert Jackson that the court would not want to abet the nation's enemies. Roosevelt's son, Elliot Roosevelt, wrote much later that his father may have been the originator of the concept of employing the IRS as a weapon of political retribution, and that his father was fascinated by other men's tax returns. In 1936, with extremist political groups seeking to benefit from the continuing Great Depression, the president had asked Edgar Hoover to acquire information about subversive activities in the United States, particularly fascism and communism. He also persuaded the FBI director to investigate his political foes, including Wendell Willkie, who during the 1940 campaign for president was pursuing an affair with Aretha Van Doren, the book editor of the New York Herald Tribune newspaper. When 8 German saboteurs, 2 of whom were naturalized American citizens, were arrested in the United States in June 1942, the furious President Roosevelt acted to forestall further infiltration and widespread terrorism in his own country. Roosevelt insisted that the 2 U.S. citizens were just as guilty as it is possible to be of high treason. Flouting due process, he claimed that the death penalty is almost obligatory, explaining privately that the only issue would be whether the men died by hanging or firing squad. He issued an executive order to try the subjects by military commission and told Biddle, "I won't give them up, and I won't hand them over to any United States Marshal armed with a writ of habeas corpus. You understand?" The Attorney General later argued that whatever their aims, the suspects had not yet committed any crime, stating, "If a man buys a pistol intending murder, that is not an attempt at murder." Nevertheless, only 6 weeks after they were arrested, 6 of the men were electrocuted. They included one of the 2 American citizens, and the other 2 men who had surrendered to the FBI, sentenced to prison. On race, the president's needle remained virtually stuck. Knowing the importance of the White South to a Democratic president and the power of white Southerners in the House and Senate, Roosevelt had even once withheld his public endorsement from an anti-lynching bill. When the military draft began, A. Philip Randolph, chief of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, came to the Oval Office and asked Roosevelt to desegregate the armed forces. The president claimed that integration had already begun, although he knew that this was scarcely true. The expanding industry of war also remained largely divided by race. The head of North American Aviation openly vowed that, no matter what their qualifications, African Americans will only be used as janitors. In the spring of 1941, Randolph planned a march on Washington to demand equal opportunities. Roosevelt was privately much upset by such a prospect. He feared alienating Southern Democrats on Capitol Hill and claimed that a march would stir up race hatred and slow up progress. At his behest, Eleanor Roosevelt wrote Randolph that a march would set back the progress that is being made. In the Oval Office, Randolph asked for an executive order on fair employment, and Roosevelt said, "Phil, you know I can't do that." When Randolph stood firm, the president issued a directive that there would be no discrimination in defense industries or government, which also established a Fair Employment Practices Committee. However, Roosevelt refused Randolph's request for a signing ceremony. Eleanor Roosevelt saw to it that a segregated public housing project in Detroit, planned largely for war production workers, was open to African Americans. But when the first black families moved in, there were angry white protesters and flaming crosses. A year later, a race riot in the same city killed 34 people and was put down only when Roosevelt sent in federal troops. By memo, the First Lady warned her husband of a growing feeling amongst the colored people that they should be allowed to participate in any training that is going on in the aviation, Army, Navy, and have opportunities for service. If Roosevelt did not act, it is going to be very bad politically because being intrinsically wrong. In April 1943, a first unit of North American pilots called the Tuskegee Airmen went to North Africa. Haters called them Eleanor's niggers. The Roosevelts personally experienced the impact of the stronger domestic surveillance than the president had approved. In a league with J. Edgar Hoover, who detested Eleanor Roosevelt's politics, the Army's Counterintelligence Corps, G2, warned the president against a gigantic conspiracy involving Eleanor's young friend, Joseph Lasch, a former socialist and pacifist of Russian Jewish heritage, who had engaged to marry a wealthy, divorced, German-born woman, Trude Pratt. Told that G2 had eavesdropped on both her and Lasch, who was being trained in Illinois as an Army weather forecaster, a furious First Lady admonished General Marshall to respect her privacy. The spies mistakenly concluded from their surveillance that she and Lasch had been intimate. An unverifiable FBI memorandum of the time claimed that when confronted by evidence of a romance, the president and his wife had a terrific fight, and Roosevelt ordered the chief of the Army Air Corps to have Lasch outside the United States and on his way to a combat post within 10 hours. Supposedly, the president also demanded that anybody who knew anything about this case also be sent to the South Pacific for action against the Japs until they were killed. In August 1943, paying for her own travel and wearing a Red Cross uniform, Eleanor Roosevelt flew to the South Pacific, Australia, and New Zealand to see the troops and the war work being performed by women. Before departure, she gave her engagement ring and other jewelry to her assistant, Malvinia Thompson, explaining who should receive each item if she should not return alive. At a reception for troops in Auckland, New Zealand, she charmingly said that she was too old to dance, since she only knew the waltz and Virginia Reel. She wrote Lorena Hickok that the people here are kind, and they like FDR, but these boys break your heart because they're so young and so tired. She found the women grimmer than during World War I. There is no feeling of adventure or thrill. She was eager to see Joe Lash, who is now at Guadalcanal, scene of the Allies' first major Pacific triumph over the Japanese. Admiral William Bull Halsey, fearing that such a junket could consume scarce resources, had warned that it would be too dangerous, but he finally relented. When the First Lady was taken to Sergeant Lash, Halsey said, "So this is the young man." After escorting her to see gruesomely wounded soldiers in military hospitals, the Admiral marveled at their expressions as she leaned over them, asking them what they needed and whether she could call their mothers. He felt ashamed of my original surliness. The First Lady had been right to fear for her life, for Guadalcanal was struck by Japanese bombers immediately before and after her visit. Returning to the White House, she proudly wrote her daughter Anna that Pa asked me more questions than I expected and actually came over to lunch with me and spent 2 hours. She told her husband Franklin that having seen how soldiers had been broken mentally and emotionally made her lie awake nights and beseeched him to ask Congress for a GI Bill like those she heard about in New Zealand and Australia, ensuring them post-war jobs and education. As Eleanor Roosevelt assimilated the horror of what she had seen in the South Pacific, she sank into a depression, which deepened when her husband did not invite her to accompany him to his upcoming first summit meeting with both Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin. That fall, Eleanor poignantly wrote her friend Esther Lapp that while there was little or no surface friction in her marriage to Franklin Roosevelt, they had no fundamental love to draw on, just respect and affection. She vowed, "I'll be a fairly good handmaiden, and with all the others to help, I think FDR's sense of a place in history will keep him on a forward-going path." Their survival war will be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.